Welcome to the Gamer's Guide to Pathfinder with Sean
and Barry.
Welcome to another episode of the Gamer's Guide. Today we're talking about party roles. We like to talk about breaking edge, you know, new content. At least it was when we recorded it, and now that you guys are finally downloading it, this is probably 2 years hence, and this is all old stuff. Today's a little different, though. This isn't anything new to role-playing. This isn't anything specific even to Pathfinder, although, you know, a little bit. But we're talking about what roles there are in your standard party in a Pathfinder role-playing game. You know, we go back, we look at things. You got your classic D&D party. All of us are going to think, you know, fighter, rogue, cleric, wizard. That's your classic, you know, I guess if you're really hardcore, old school, first edition, you think, you know, elf, dwarf. But, you know, we're talking classes here, not necessarily. Well, and I guess I should even stop there. We're not talking classes, we're talking the roles themselves. As we talk about this a bit more, you'll see many classes can fit many roles, but are they typecast? You know, it doesn't matter. So, talking about party roles, I guess the very first thing is it a useful discussion? Is talking about what roles are in a party, is that useful to a role player? It doesn't matter if you're forming a gaming group to know what roles people are going to fill in the party, or is that just metagame wanking?
Well, I know from my experience whether or not I would like to do that. Personally, I think it'd be fun for people to, you know, make the character they want to play and go with it and deal with what they find in the world. However, I found in my experience that there's always at least one guy in the group, if not the group consensus, that upon creation, if they're creating at the table at the same time, they want to talk about, okay, guys, well, who wants to play the healer, who wants to play the tank, and they automatically pigeonhole themselves. They automatically try to fill those gaps. And is that necessarily a bad thing? I think if they take this campaign seriously and they seriously want to survive and, quote, win, that's how they're looking at it. They want to make sure they have the tools to do the job.
Can we actually get through a standard challenge?
Absolutely, yeah. But they can't ignore it, or they think that they can't ignore it. So perhaps that's something we can touch on too. Can you ignore that? If you approach it with good planning and ingenuity, can you get through things that are supposed to require the standard four with just three, or with two, or, you know, what happens
sure.
to the fifth guy?
Sure. And I've heard arguments that if you're starting a game at 15th level, everyone can just play wizards and you'll do the best out of any party that goes through it. And there might be some legitimacy to that, because wizards aren't that good. But, you know, in all seriousness, so I guess before we skip ahead too far, one of the things I'd like to say is we're going to talk a bit about some of our own campaigns, some of our own experience here, so we'll try not to geek out too much on our own gaming stories, but if they're good examples, we will bring them up. So you said that in your experience, a lot of people come up with roles that they want filled within the party. What are those roles? What are the ones that you hear have to, you know, whether they're correct or not, what are the ones that are the common zeitgeist, the consensus out there that these are the roles that have to be filled? The
first one is healer, always.
Okay.
The next one,
so,
usually I think it's taken for granted that someone is going to be a melee fighter. So you really don't hear the call to arms for, hey, who's going to play the tank? Usually there's someone who is has the itch to do that. The next one in line to get shoved into is probably the rogue slash trap finder. After that, it's really, those are the two. Those are really the two, I think, workhorses, the jobs that people often don't want to do. And then from there, I mean, playing a mage is fun, right?
So in your experience, is that the big thing people are looking for is what are the things that people typically don't want to do, and those are the ones that are asked about?
Well, I think by and large, a lot of players don't understand what a cleric is really supposed to do.
Sure.
And so they think that the cleric is the heal bot.
Okay. So they're asking, who's playing the healer?
Absolutely.
And in many cases, someone, you know, I'm going to take one for the team, I'm going to play the cleric, or I'm going to play the healer.
Right.
And, you know, they're falling on their sword, and oh, woe is me, rather than realizing that they're playing a Godzilla who can destroy half the stuff by themselves while everyone else drinks tea, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. I think that's part of it, too, and we can, as we go, I think we're going to get into that it's more than just filling the roles, but I think people, when depending on how they look at it, they pigeonhole themselves, and I think they're limiting themselves by how they view their characters. I mean, your character is only as good and only as able as you make it. You can have all the tools and all the levels and all the skills, but if you can't utilize them, you may as well be playing a commoner.
Sure.
Or a commoner that can detect traps, or a commoner that can cast Cure Light Wounds.
I guess my counterpoint would be, you know, if I know my team is relying on me to do something, I can, one, build a character to do that efficiently and well, and then know that I can do those other things, but I'm not being relied upon to do those. So knowing who's counting on me to do something or not, and whether there's redundancy within the party to do that role, makes a big difference to me. So if I'm making a cleric, and my team is just going to cry themselves to sleep at night if I don't heal them in combat occasionally, and I can't convince them that that's not a good use of my time, should I be doing that in combat? Maybe that's what they're relying on me to do, and then I could show them how I'm also fighting better than the fighter. But you know, I mean, is and maybe that's a bad example because I just wanted to pick on people, but you know, knowing what they need me to do, if I need to be the trap finder of the party and I decide not to ever put any ranks into perception, you know, I'm falling down on the job. If the party's relying on me to do the damage output, and I'm more interested in, you know, I don't want to pick on any specific people here who might listen to it later, but you know, I they're relying on me for damage, and I'm just not bringing, I'm not bringing it to the fight. You know, I'm not earning my share of the treasure, so to speak. I'm also making other people make up for me there. So, I mean, it kind of matters what it is. If they're expecting a role out of you, but you don't know what that role is, or you don't care and ignore it, the party as a whole may suffer.
Sure. Well, answering your questions, I guess, kind of in order, getting back to the cleric and healing, I think that how you approach the character in-game when you basically gear up for the day, when you spell up for the day, they have a nice little feature in there that they've had since 3.0 where you can memorize whatever you want, sacrifice it for the heal. So you can go into those combats prepared to buff yourself or others. And then if this stuff really hits the fan and you're like, hey,
you
I really
heal,
you can
you
still
to,
do
yeah.
that, so they can get those occasional heals in combat if someone's going to, you know, die, you want to save
if
them.
And if you're proving them how awesome it is without it, you're doing enough damage that you don't need it
absolutely.
In the first place, and you're explaining rocket.
And hey, if you are blowing all your spells on buffs, you say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm out of spells, I buffed everyone.
Yep.
Really, they can cry themselves to sleep, but there's not much you can do when you're out of spells.
Right. And hey, if you don't like it, play it yourself. So I guess maybe we should jump right into that then. You know, a huge controversy, and this could almost be a episode in itself, except I know we both somewhat agree on this.
Sure.
But, you know, is healing a good use of resources in combat?
I say that that is situational. It depends not only on a specific combat. It also depends on the players.
I can think of situations where it would be useful, but as a general rule...
As a general rule, the faster you eliminate, and that doesn't mean kill, it could be incapacitate, it could mean reverse gravity, the faster you...
Hey, if you've got a good face, man, you know, incapacitating is far better than killing in a lot of cases.
Absolutely. The faster you disarm your opponents in whatever way, shape, or form, then you're not taking damage.
Yeah.
So in that way, the offense, it becomes your defense.
And a lot of people have likened D&D and Pathfinder in any of its incarnations to rocket tag, they'll say. The more damage you can do as quickly as possible, the better off you're going to be. If you look at just healing spells, say at first level, you're casting a healing spell that does a D8 plus 1 healing. If you compare that to what the half-orc barbarian level 1 that you're fighting can put out, he's doing a D12 plus 4, say. You can't keep up. Even if you had all the spells in the day, there, if he hits every time, you can't keep up, and you don't have that many spells. You can't keep up. He only has so many hit points, though, so if you say, well, there's four of us, if we all actually hit him, instead of me wasting my time healing and you're in combat, he's going to die. And that really does become a bigger and bigger problem as you go up in levels. You just can't heal as quickly as they can damage. And so you just, if you can damage them first, then they're not doing any damage to you. If they die, they aren't doing damage. So in general, in my opinion, and there are certain times when that's not the case, but for the most part, as a general rule, healing just isn't a very effective role in combat, and certainly not something I would build a character around. Now, like you talked about, though, you know, if you can sub out those spells when necessary, fan-freaking-tastic! That's awesome! I mean, if someone's about to go down, the only hit point that matters is your last hit point, right? I'm at one hit point. Well, that's the one that matters. And if you can keep that fighter going down so he can keep doing damage, that's a good use of a heal spell. It's fantastic.
I say the best healer in the game is a Wand of Cure Light Wounds.
Yeah, so many people can use it. It's, you know, most effective by...
Per charge, per gold
per charge, right.
Yeah.
So it's a great way to go.
Pass it around.
Yeah. It's a very, very good roll. And you could have a couple people who have one. You know, potions are the same way. You get an emergency little cork that you pop out, and you can drink it and stay up, and it doesn't use someone else's action.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, there's ways that we know, and I think that these aren't... This is... Right now, what we're talking about isn't completely new to most listeners. There's ways you can get around the healing conundrum with potions and wands and so on and so forth. Traps, that's a little different.
Yeah.
There's obviously some spells that can bypass traps. There's movement that can bypass the physical movement.
But it's interesting. In Pathfinder, I think they actually changed that dynamic in my mind a bit. So you have basically two types of trap, magical and non-magical. If you don't have trap finding, you can't disarm magical traps.
Right.
Right? So that's our big void that we have. Do we need someone who has trap finding? Well, if someone maxes out perception, they can find the stuff. You can then make a decision. If they have disabled device, you can disable the stuff, unless it's magic. Now, if you have trap finding, you get bonuses to that. You're even higher. It's a good deal, that sort of thing. But is it necessary, in my mind, for non-magical traps? No.
I would agree. I think that by the time, generally speaking, and this isn't saying not necessarily the door trapping your end module bad guy, but generally speaking, by the time your party starts consistently running into magical traps that are potent enough for you to worry about, your party mage, which again this relies on the four square again, but your party mage or cleric should be able to dispel those.
Yep.
Or have a decent chance of doing so.
Which is the big thing. I mean, if you have a high-level magic spell, which you need trap finding to get rid of, well, you know, my level 0 detect magic is going to find it, because it glows.
Right.
And my level 3 dispel magic at this high-level huge thing is going to get rid of it. So it's just not necessary, in my mind. And that's not necessarily true before Pathfinder. You know, in 3.5, I kind of, you know, I wanted someone with trap finding in the party. Didn't need to be a rogue. There's lots of other choices. You know,
sure.
It got you trap finding, whereas there's fewer now who get trap finding. But trap finding now, it just isn't as important now.
The skills in Pathfinder have been broadened and kind of moved around and, I guess, smoothed out, if you will. More classes can take more skills, even if they don't get as many skill points, even if they're not class skills.
Right, the only difference is that +3.
Right.
At low levels, that makes a difference, but at high levels, that +3 isn't as huge.
Not as big of a deal. So, yeah, you can have your fighter, if he has the skill points available, messing around trying to disable the device.
If that's what makes, you know, you floats your boat for a fighter, yeah, you can absolutely make that. And
to the rogue's credit, though, they got a big buff, I think.
Well, they're still skill-based, so they...
Sure.
They benefit from that from every other skill.
Well, and the combination of so many skills down in, distilled into one skill...
Right.
They have essentially a whole lot more skill
points. They're the same skill points, but there's less skills to choose from, so their percentage of skills covered went up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well put. But what I was saying is also the addition of the rogue talents, they have many more abilities, so the fact that their trap finding isn't as great as it was in 3.5, when you look at a rogue at full, you know, straight up rogue progression, they really kind of peter out. I mean, you're just going for sneak damage, and you really don't get anything until, you know, those mid levels when, hey, I've got these rogue talents that start like way, way later in the game, and now you get those from level 2.
Yeah.
So, and really, you know, for the fun factor, and this is what it, obviously, I know you'll agree, it's all about how well are people enjoying the game. Directly corresponds to how well do they enjoy their character. If they can focus on the things that are fun earlier on, say like in a rogue, they're not waiting so long, they can build a character and they say, hey, at every single level I'm getting either a feat or a rogue talent, I'm doing something fun. That's an okay trade-off for not having great trap finding skills, I think.
Oh, I agree. It's not a horrific class, even though we make fun of it all the time, you know, because you can just play ninja. But mostly that's tongue-in-cheek. It can be a very fun class to play. I think it's a little more challenging to build a good rogue who really does a good job than it is, you know, say a paladin who kind of, just by nature being a paladin, you're pretty cool, a little easier.
I think some classes, and this will speak to the four square, the idea of that balance party, some classes I think are going to really shine at low levels. A rogue is fantastic at low levels. When you don't have a ton of magic power in the party, you're relying more on skills, you're relying more on social situations to go by the skin of your nuts. The rogue is really good. When you start getting in mid and high levels, and you know the wizard and the cleric can just do all these things, the magic abilities of a bard, say, will start showing up, and as you illustrated quite well, anyone who puts appropriate skills can kind of do these things. The rogue really starts to be, you know, a lot less good, I think. So, I mean, and there are, that's not the only class that's like that. So, you know, you need to look at what you're going to do. How long is this, you know, where are you starting the party at? How long is it going to go for? Rogue is a fine choice in the low-level game.
So it seems like one of our running themes in our podcast here is know what kind of game you're going to play, know what level you're starting at, know what level you're ending at, think about what you're making. I mean, I think that's all just solid advice no matter what we're doing here.
Right.
I guess calling it back to the healer real quick here, we talked about how we don't think healing, you know, hit point healing is useful in combat. What about, you know, debuff or undoing debuffs when they get put on your people in your party and, you know, restoring con damage or dex damage or strength damage, you know, things that are could potentially stop someone in combat. Is that a needed role in a group?
You
and
know,
is that encompassed in the healer? I mean, so obviously that's something the cleric is good at as your prototypical healer. Those are air quotes there for people who can't see me in this non-video podcast.
If he says prototypical, he's doing air quotes. Well, you know, that gets, that opens up the counterspell discussion, really.
Sure.
When you're talking about the majority of those debuffs, or a lot of those debuffs, those are going to be arcane spells. The person most equipped to deal with that is going to be your party arcane caster, either through counterspells or through being prepared, identifying the enemy caster, and getting to him first. A lot of times, you know, you take a mage to kill a mage, and you need to have your party be ready to deal with those types of threats. I think when it comes out of those, sometimes, I mean, this applies to life, really. There's not always an answer for every conundrum.
Right.
Sometimes the best answer is to avoid it in the first place. So, really, try not to get hit with too much ability damage. I mean,
what you're saying is don't play entrance game. You're gonna get con damage every game,
right? Well, even that isn't too bad. But you know, if you get hit by a whole bunch of debuffs, you know, right away, it could go really sour.
Sure.
And at that point, no, you know, even then, you would have to ask yourself: is trying to give the fighter 3 more points of strength back going to be better than the things that I can do with my spells to manipulate the battlefield or to, you know, hurt the BBEG?
Yeah.
And if you could avoid that, then absolutely. If you could do something immediately to, you know, counteract that, then that'd be great. But if you're going to have to spend, you know, action economy, if you're going to have to spend your actions to try to undo that, then it just becomes that same problem with, you know, the level 1 healer and the level 1 barbarian. Can
sure.
you keep up?
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's the opposite of, you know, way. Buffing is extremely efficient if you're doing the whole party.
Sure.
So if you can haste the entire party rather than just give one person a +1 to hit, clearly a better choice, right? No one's going to argue that. You get much more bang for your buck with that spell. Likewise, if your party is slowed and you can get rid of that in one shot, you get a lot more bang for your buck.
Sure.
So it absolutely is situational, but my general opinion is it still is more of an out-of-combat thing in most situations. If exactly what you were saying, if that fighter has strength damage and he's taken -4 strength, that's a -2 to hit, -2 to damage, is that going to net more damage to the bad guy than me just hitting the bad guy? And if the answer isn't yes, then you got better things to do. The problem is people get scared when their primary stat is hit. There's a much bigger psychological, and I love playing on this as a GM, players hate it. If you've got a rogue in the party and he's a dex-based rogue and that's his big thing is dex, and you hit his dex, even though that's the worst thing to hit because he's got the most of it, so it's going to be hardest to take him out by hitting dex, he's freaked out because, oh my god, my best stat is going down. And it seems to have, even though he's never in danger and they successfully complete the combat, they were more afraid in that combat than they would have been otherwise, which is a beautiful, beautiful GM trick for you guys. Play on their fears, and there are fears in the mechanics of the game that people have. They don't like it when people mess with that. You know, I mean, same with if you take a spellbook away from a caster, it's a horrible, horrible thing to do to that wizard. Don't do it very often, but it can be real fun to do it occasionally because it makes for them freaked out. And I'm not saying that's just a minor thing that will only last one combat unless they get it back at the end of the combat, so don't run around sundering their spellbook, but it can be fun to play with them.
Well, if you're going to take the spellbook away, you got to take away for at least one day so you can have a day with no spells.
You don't even need to. It could have no effect in the whole round because they're freaked out that they didn't have it for 2 combats.
Oh, come on. It would be fun.
It would be fun, but I'm saying you don't even need to and you could still get that emotional impact.
How often does he get to play a level 9 commoner?
Right? You think you're God. You're nothing. Without your book or your fox if you're a witch. know, the dog catcher is the the big problem we just have.
So getting back to the standard four, I guess the question that we're trying to tackle, or that we're trying to talk about here, is this idea valid? We know that the four square, we know the standard four does work. We know that if you build a party like that and you build it, you know, in a fairly, not even optimized, if you just don't mess it up, you're going to probably make it through your standard AP.
Yeah, and in fact, most of them assume that's what you have, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the assumption is you can deal with traps. The assumption is you can heal damage that comes out. The assumption is if there's an invisible flying creature, you got someone who can, you know, do something about that and help take that creature out in the party. If you don't have those abilities, life becomes much harder for you.
Okay, so going on that, I guess what I'm curious is, what I'd like to talk about, is can you effectively make a party without those archetypical people? If you take out one or two of them, what sorts of combos, how can they cover each other's bases? How can it work in, you know, a four-player party or in a three-player party or so on and so forth?
So my answer to that is yes, with planning. So you can build a really effective group who's all half rogues themselves. You know, they've all taken some levels of rogues. They're going in ninja style, and they're going through stuff all sneaky-like, and they're avoiding confrontations. They're, you know, doing stuff as a group that synergizes well and goes through. But if they didn't plan that out and they just decided, no one felt like playing a fighter. No one felt like playing someone who could soak up the damage up front. We're all decided to play people in the back. And, you know, I'm an archer ranger, of course, because they're the best ranger, or the best archer. and another guy is, you know, he's going to play the level one wizard with the intent of being a blaster. And another guy, you know, I mean, they're all just backline guys, and their orcs all rush up and slaughter them all because they weren't ready for that, because no one talked about it, thought about it, and figured, hey, how are we going to deal with those situations? But if they talk about it and come up with a plan for that, yeah, I think it can be very successful.
Okay. Well, getting away, I know we just came off of dipping in the last episode, so I wouldn't want to assume that people would be dipping levels of rogue multiple people.
Sure.
But one of the things that I'd like to address, I remember reading an article way, way back when in Dragon Magazine. It was kind of one of those side ones that's very cartoony, but it talked about gearing your party like a SWAT team, and your fighter,
yeah, I remember that one.
Your fighter gearing down from the plate into the masterwork studded leather. And I think that that's a fair point, because especially in Pathfinder now, more so than when that article came out, 3.0 and 3.5, with skills as accessible as they are, a fighter with a decent dex, say, taking off his full plate armor and getting in that masterwork studded leather,
sure,
can have a fair chance to sneak right next to the rogue.
Well, and maybe as they scale up in levels, he can even put that full plate back on, because he's getting rid of his armor check penalty, which is the big problem with wearing full plate, is it's lowering your stealth scores, it's lowering those other scores that make it so you can't sneak. He, more than any other class,
sure,
can bring that back down. And
specifically the fighter.
But it's planning again.
But we could apply
it's
that
he
to...
He knows he wants to do that. He knows he wants to sneak, so he needs to take that into account when he makes his character.
Right. That specifically for the fighter, but what I'm saying is apply that to the cavalier, apply that to the
sure
paladin. You could have a sneaky paladin if you do the things in-game to prepare yourself.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like equipping well,
yeah,
getting that free 10-foot cliche pull.
Well, it's even more than just equipping, though. I really think you have to have a build that works with that. I mean, if you're still wanting to play the tank and your plan is to have a nice high AC and you decide to wear leather and you didn't come up with any other plan to get a high AC, you're kind of screwed. You know, you didn't plan well. You got to know what you're going to do and you got to...
Well, that's a good question. Is the high AC necessary? We're talking about being able to bypass excessive heals or any heals at all by the rocket tag, as you say. Can you apply the same thing to the AC argument? Do you really need to have a super defense if you're focusing on offense? If you blow those things out of the water quickly,
they can't hit you as much. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yep, very true. You know, there are people out there who will argue that carrying a shield is a trap. It raises your AC, but it's lowering your damage potential significantly if you're a strength-based build compared to a two-handed weapon. And they would argue that that's not a good trade because of that rocket tag theory and exactly what you were just talking about. My personal opinion is, if I'm building a tank, I have to have one a way that I'm going to deal with damage, and that could be the answer, is I'm going to put out so much damage so fast that they don't have a chance to hurt me back as much. And a barbarian comes to mind as a great way to do that.
Sure.
You know, you have high hit points in case you need it, but you can put out, you know, more damage. And so that's if that's how you want to build your tank, great. And maybe you want to build it as a high AC tank who's not going to put out a lot of damage, but he has some other way of keeping them focused on him. They can't hit him. His friends all burn him down. But know how you're going to fill your role. I don't think there's any one way to fill any role. So if you're the tank, there's so many different ways you could build a tank. You could, you know, control the area around you with trips. You could have a high AC. You could play with the antagonize. You could, you know, do all sorts of weird, crazy things that could be fun. And some of them will work, some of them won't. You know, you got to actually analyze them and see how good it is for the situation, how good it is with your group. But, yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways you could do a lot of the things.
Well, regarding the shield as a trap comment, my opinion on that would be, as long as you're not shooting for the middle. If you are lightly armored and everything else, you're low AC, adding a plus 2 to your AC really isn't going to help. But if you are building that high armor tank, having the shield is absolutely not a trap. It's going to polish you off with an extra plus 2 or plus 4, not even counting the magical bonuses you're going to get later.
Right, which could be huge, yeah.
Your armored kilt and so on and so forth.
All right, so I did some research here before the show, and I going online, looking at some of the discussions people are having about what they think the roles are. The big four that came up were tank, striker, controller, and healer. And striker, people get all up in arms about because that's a term for one of the roles in 4th edition, because 4th edition actually laid out these are the different roles mechanically. And they get all up in arms because it's not the same thing. But is that a role, in your opinion, in the party? Is someone who can put out a bunch of damage at once, is that one of the roles in the party? That someone can say, this is what I'm doing to support the team. I'm putting out lots of damage.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Makes sense to me, right?
Generally, you need to stop the creatures from swinging at you. And the best way to do that, well, I mean, maybe not the best way to do that, but the most consistent way to do that is to lower their hit point total.
Yeah.
So the striker becomes very useful.
It's the most obvious, straightforward what you do. And in fact, I would say if you're going to talk about a role being necessary, this is it.
Very well convinced.
Can you have a party who can't do damage? You know, I mean, everyone needs to do it. Whether it's everyone doing it or the party.
It depends on the campaign. It depends on the campaign. I think that you could very well have a combo with, you know, a sly rogue and a wizard. And as long as they're in a city or in situations where they can use social skills and spells, I mean, illusions, enchantments, and diplomacy.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
So, you know, everything. I think, you know, I hate to give that ambiguous answer, but I really think
everything
it just goes back to what you're doing. Yeah, absolutely.
And we're really going to come back to that here in a little bit.
In an undead-heavy campaign, I mean, you could very well define one of the necessary roles into undead blaster. Do we have an undead blaster in the group?
Well, isn't that the same as just saying you didn't do a lot of damage?
Sure, no, but I mean specifically to undead, because, say, like clerics with a turn ability and then certain domains, more so in 3.5 than in Pathfinder, but you could really build your character to just annihilate and or control undead. And
controlling would be an example of not needing the damage so much as...
Sure, but what I'm saying is, you know, you could very well define that as a needed party element, and so when you're building, you say, hey, we're going to do this long Ravenloft campaign. Who is going to help mitigate the undead threat? And so someone may have to step up. So it really does, I think, get back to the campaign. If we were getting into something that a game that is just super heavy in the role play and there's lots of intrigue and mystery, you know, I think that's going to be on the table. Hey, who is going to, more than in any other game, who's going to be the party face? Who is going to diplomat? Who is going to use these social skills? Not just in passing, not just to try to get the nether clue so we can run up to the dungeon.
And I would actually put that up as a strong party role as well. That's something.
Sure.
If I, you know, I read a lot of adventures. I really enjoy reading adventures, and to me, an adventure that doesn't have the social components is not nearly as fun as one that does. I want to play adventures that have social components. I want someone to be filling that role. You get a lot more information. They're a lot more interactive. It's a lot more fun in my mind.
I agree 100%.
I really like having that role in a party. Is it necessary?
The problem is,
Sean... I don't have as much fun without it, so... Yeah.
Well, but the problem is who actually sits down and rolls up an aristocrat? So that's why what happens is those skills, while necessary or very, very good for flavor reasons, become secondary. You are a sorcerer primarily, and then, oh yeah, you have a great charisma, so you decided to max out these social skills that you already have a great bonus to.
See, and I guess I'd look at it the other way, whereas I want someone in the party to be the face. Now I have a bunch of choices that can do that, and I could fill out some other roles, but my role as those other sorcerer, you know, as a blaster, as a sorcerer, is secondary to my role as face.
I think that's a great way to approach it. I don't, however, think that that is the way that is approached commonly.
Standard. Okay, standard, fair enough. Right? Yeah. Fair enough. I guess I did want to touch real quick on ranged versus melee combat in Pathfinder.
Okay.
Since we're talking about the strikers here and how much damage they can put out, that sort of thing, Pathfinder did a good job of bringing your non-spellcasting ranged fighter back into line with your melee fighter.
High five, deadly aim.
Yeah, absolutely. It really did a good job with the feats. It did a good job of making it so it's not just one class that can fit that role. Anyone can do that. High five, good job for them.
And they're continuing that with the different archetypes. I'm a big fan of the Zen Archer Monk.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things, you know, people talk about with Pathfinder now is if you're playing a tank type character, you still have to put out a lot of damage. And you'll be just as good at putting out damage in a lot of cases as your typical striker is. So if the guy's the fighter, he's expecting to take a lot of hits, he needs to put out as much damage as does the rogue. One, is that a reasonable assertion?
I think it depends on the character. I mean, rarely. I mean, you don't necessarily have to, but it's always good. If you're standing there anyway, why wouldn't you want to put out damage?
Okay. But if you can, if Pathfinder allows you to make a tank character who can also put out as much damage as the striker, why would anyone play a striker? Why not just have a bunch of tanks?
Well, what becomes your striker? I mean, as we elaborated on before, if the rogue is your prototypical burst damage melee striker, well, he's also chock full of skills. He's also your trap guy. So the fact that he's not able to sit there and be the tank, well, that's okay. He has other things that he does.
So, yeah, I completely agree. And I think the answer is how with a nice overlap. Filling just one role, everyone's overlapping into multiple things. Which ways do you want to overlap? You don't all want to overlap the same things. You all want to overlap differently.
Well, really, I think that makes for a better gelled party anyway. I mean, how would you like it if your coworker said, you know, it's not in my job description. I'm sorry, I can't open that door. No, no. I know the rogue is lying unconscious on the floor, but I
work for the government sometimes. That's all I had to say. Yeah.
But, you know, no, if you can make the tank do a lot of damage, then great. The more party roles, if they're more overlapping, I think is better. I'm not personally the type of player who says, oh man, that guy's stepping on my toes because he did X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to roll up two redundant characters, but at the same time, if you can overlap and basically protect those weak spots in the group, then it just makes for a stronger group.
Which I think is another good point. There are players out there who feel like their player has to fill one of these niches, and if anyone else touches their niche, you're stealing their enjoyment of the game from them.
And I think that's totally valid. So when the tank goes down, and there's no one to, for lack of a better term, off tank, what happens to the party?
You know, it doesn't matter because now we miss him.
Right. Okay, or when your cleric goes down because no one else could have heals because he's the only one allowed to have that cure light wounds, who is going to heal people?
Yeah.
Or who is going to Nova and take care of those undead that are killing everybody?
Sure. I personally completely concur. You know, one of the things I would say is, if you had a couple people swinging swords in combat, you don't feel that they're stealing the light from you, you know, just because you're also a sword swinger. It makes sense that everyone's fighting in combat. It makes sense that, you know, if there's two archers, it's no big deal. If one person's the archer, it's not stealing their life for someone else to shoot a bow.
I know that if I was in a situation where I had to shoot a bow for my life, and I had a guy right next to me also shooting a bow, that would make me happy.
Yeah. Yeah. The more the merrier, right? I mean, absolutely. If I ever got in a situation where I felt I needed to shoot a gun at someone, absolutely anyone else is more than welcome to jump in there and also shoot at my target.
That's 100%. What I'm saying. If I'm in full play, if I'm in full play with a shield or not, on the front lines hacking and trying to stave off this onslaught of orcs, I want another guy at my side.
I think. Well, even if you look at it story wise as a niche in a story, the Knights of the Round Table all had basically the same skill set, right? I mean, they're all running around swinging their sword at someone and blocking with their shield, and yet they still were very interesting characters and unique flowers and snowflakes who came down and all were, you know,
well, that's a good
their
point.
Own thing.
Yeah. Right, the character should be more than just his job.
Yeah.
And I think that's what will help to make a party shine, you know, in any situation.
Sure.
The fact that you flesh it out and it's not just a collection of stats.
And the reason I'm bringing that up, it feels like a lot of times the people who...
Oh, this is a war game, absolutely, first and foremost.
It is, yeah.
I had this conversation earlier today, and that it was with O'Neill, actually, and it was sad, because I was talking about I think Pathfinder did a much better job than Wizards did with 3.0, 3.5, in that the tactics aren't quite in the forefront. But, you know, especially, you know, with those 3.5 players, and they're going to flame on me, but if you have a first, second, and third place, absolutely the war game tactics are front and center,
mm-hmm.
and then the role play aspect is
maybe
a distant third.
Yeah, well, I don't need rules to govern my role playing as much as I need rules to govern my combat. So, yeah.
Right, but it overtakes that, I think.
Yeah,
how cinematic is that when you craft some, you know, great entrance or great inter conflict between two NPCs that the party gets to watch, or some cinematic thing, and instantly, I mean, for lack of any,
everyone zones out and they don't care.
Almost worse yet is, you know, your NPC comes in and they do something in the flower spring, and instead of being wowed or awed, the first thing that comes out of your player's mouth is, oh gee, I know what spell they cast, or they cast this, or oh, they're calculating in their head, well, what level must they be if they actually cast that spell, and or do they have this piece of equipment, and they're already eyeballing the NPC for what they can pick off of their dead corpse in the future. You know, I think that the more you can get away from seeing the characters, not just your own characters.
So sort of the suspension of disbelief isn't there because of the rules mechanics?
Yeah, I'm not blaming any one thing. I'm just saying that when a system is allowed to be taken as more of a war game, but it's designed to be kind of a war game, but if you don't, what I'm saying is that if you don't actively try to make the focus on the role-playing and have the combat further the story and further the role-play, then it devolves into a war game. That's all I'm saying.
Fair enough.
So, and those types of things are what force people into these situations of the Foursquare, where they're saying, well, gee, I really don't want to play that, but these guys are saying we have to have a healer.
Yeah.
But that's really not what I wanted to do, but gosh, I guess I have to play that rogue and do those traps.
Yeah.
And that sucks. I think that first and foremost...
Well, my advice would be, in that situation, if you have a party, you're all talking about roles, which is fantastic. At first you should all high-five each other because you're actually talking about things beforehand, and that's awesome. It doesn't always happen. But if you find yourself in that situation where you're like, man, we're missing this role, the default answer shouldn't be someone falls on their sword and plays the role they didn't want to play. The default answer should be, okay, cool, I'm going to play this guy, but how can we deal with that as a party? How are we don't have it there, but how do we deal with it? And maybe the answer is, well, I'm playing a rogue, I'll just make sure I focus a little and use magic device and get that up there, and we can use wands, and oh, I can use one over here because I'm a paladin, and that's your answer. Maybe that's how you deal with no one playing the healer, is you just talk about it ahead of time, everyone knows what they're going to do to step in and make sure that that's covered and off you roll and everyone's happy, rather than someone having fallen on their sword and spending the next 2 years playing a character they didn't really like.
I think that's a really good point. Getting back to the rogue just for a quick second, is that looking for rogue functionality and doing something other than looking for traps and burst damage, with the use magic device, the rogue really can step up and be the off healer, off caster, off insert whatever, with those use magic device and shore up the needed thing for the party at the time.
We joke about how a wizard can do anything.
But he can't
do
anything.
You can put that into wands, and then the rogue by mid-levels can do anything, right? I mean...
Sure, absolutely. And the wizard can do anything, but the semi-balancing thing about a wizard is they generally can't do everything all the time.
Right.
So they can gear up to be this for this day, but then they're not those other things.
Right.
And so without excessive scrying abuse...
As long as we ignore scrolls.
But even that costs money.
Sure.
And they, you still have action economy. You can only cast so many spells per round.
Yeah, and I would argue that the thing with money is, if you're out there doing everything, you're making more money. Therefore, you can afford more squirrels.
Sure.
Yeah.
You can afford wands too.
Getting your money. Yeah. Yeah. Just saying.
Well, I mean, no one's gonna argue that the rogue is more useful or more powerful than the wizard.
I know, and I know you're
saying
are.
That it's a nice secondary role for the rogue, for lack of something else better to do. They can shore up those things, and they can be the off insert whatever.
Right, they can do any of those things that the wizard isn't doing. They can take whatever their role is and be that much better at it.
Right, through use magic device.
Yeah, it's a fantastic thing for them to be doing. Absolutely. All right, so the last role then that I found is one of the typical four that you come up as a requirement is controller. Now, I'm a big fan of controllers. I love them. I'm not convinced they're necessary for a group.
I don't think they're necessary at all. I think that they're definitely effective.
Absolutely.
I think that they make combats much, much easier. I think it's one of those things where you would tend to not find them planned for so much. I think they're the one thing that can break an adventure path, pre-designed combat more than anything. That, you know, because there's so many spells, there's so many creative ways to use spells.
If you have someone who can read the encounter, figure out where the linchpin of that encounter is,
absolutely,
and remove it, the encounter falls apart.
Right, and so those, I don't think they're needed, and I don't think that most, except for possibly the super badass, we're going to kill you hard adventures that are made, I don't think they're planning for a controller to be in the group, or that there may be one there, but it's not going to be effective enough to alter the course in some drastic way. So I think if you were going to lose one thing, you could lose the controller and you'd be fine.
Sure.
Also, I mean, it's a collection of living, thinking beings, so they can generally, I mean, unless they're just really pigeonholed into, hey, you got to fight or die, most of the time they can approach situations, hopefully, and they can think about it in different ways, and they can decide what course of action.
You know, I'd also throw out there, and no one's argued this point here necessarily, but a lot of times it seems like the assumption is that a controller has to be a caster. I'm going to put out there that a tank often can be a melee controller as the way that he keeps attention.
Fighter's maybe a great controller.
Yeah, absolutely. He's just a melee, non-magic controller. He's tripping, he's disarming, he's sundering, he's changing the battlefield without doing direct damage and, you know, making it an easier combat. That's absolutely control. And again, it's not necessary, it's not the only way to do that job, but
I think that's a really good point, and I think that on the idea of being a quote tank, the idea is that for some magical reason the creatures, or at least one of them, or at least the one you really are worried about, is going to be swinging against him.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you're dealing with intelligent or highly intelligent critters, why would they initially do that?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they identify the caster or the archer
level? And you have a 35 AC, and I can't touch you.
Right, why would you sit there and swing at me?
Why wouldn't I just provoke that attack of opportunity, run right on by you, charge after the caster who's in the back, and squish the squishy?
That's what I'm saying.
It's worth taking that one hit to go back there and do it. Why wouldn't I do it? I'm a hyper-intelligent whatever.
And getting back to the secondary role of the tank that we're talking about, if he's able to have a good damage output, does that make him more of a target? So you can't hit him, and he's doing a fair amount of damage. I don't know if I would want to stand next to that person.
Yeah.
However, if instead of focusing on damage-dealing capabilities, that, say, prototypical fighter focuses on control abilities, he can move himself, he can move his opponent, he can alter the combat. Even if the enemy doesn't want to engage him, he can force that engagement. And so being a controller, I think, makes him a better tank. If you had to pick one or the other, I would go controller tank.
In some situations. So again, it goes back to talking to your party. If you're playing with someone who's a rogue, and their whole thing is they're going to rely on you to be their flank buddy as they come to hit this guy, and you're just moving him around to keep their attention, and he's like, hey, I was flanking him, but you moved him. And on the other hand, he's in melee range with the thing, too. There's no facing. There's no reason he can't get hit just as much. So if he's dealing a ton of damage and you're just tripping the guy, he's going to hit that rogue who was hoping not to get hit. So it's not that...
Well, if you're doing a job as a controller, though, maybe he's not hitting that rogue. If he's prone, disarmed.
Right, right. But my point is that stolen his magical items. How do those two roles work together? And you need to talk about that ahead of time and not just kind of go out there and one guy's like, I optimized this assuming you were going to do that. And you're like, well, I assumed I was going to do this and not that. And so you're stuck. So I mean, just talking about those things ahead of time, I guess, is my point. Because it's a fantastic way to do things.
Sure.
The melee controller, big fan. I love it. It's how I want to play my melee type characters. But if someone else is relying again on me to do something else, and just because they assumed I was your prototypical, you know, armored tank and nothing else, then we're missing out on something as a party in synergy. So that'd be my only caveat. It's a fantastic thing. I love it. I think Pathfinder does a great job of really bringing more of that to your melee fighters. Make sure you talk about how you're going to do that, how you're going to, you know, what kind of character he is, and get all excited. Be, hey, I'm building this guy, and he can do this and that and this and that. And, you know, even that is telling them what you expect your guy to be doing so that they're not coming up with false expectations. Or if they do have them, they can bring it up right then before anything's set in stone.
Okay, so getting away from the standard four square of the party, let's cut it down to three. Do you think that can work? Can we make a three-player party that can effectively go through an adventure path, say, and succeed?
So my answer is, even with staying with these same roles, yes. Because we talked about overlap, you can cover the same thing with three people, just your overlap's in different places. On the other hand, you don't need these four necessarily. Yeah, you can, as long as we go back to what I talked about with the, you know, we're missing X, how do we deal with that? As long as you have an answer, yeah, you can do that, no problem. So I guess my question back to you then would be, if you have a party who is only three players and they don't want to take care of how they're filling one of the roles, should the DM or GM, I guess in the case of Pathfinder, should they change their adventure to tailor to that party?
I don't think so. For me, when I play the game, part of it is it's assumed realism, but the idea that there is an effect, or I guess in my mind, the DM is the reaction to the player's action, or it is the wall that you bounce your racquetball off of, that it should be there. If there are goblins in the forest, there should be goblins in the forest. If there's trolls in the forest, there should be trolls in the forest. The fact that we're wandering in there a second level doesn't mean that the trolls are magically now goblins.
Sure. So if I'm the bad guy and I'm going to build traps in my fort,
and we decide not to take a rogue, then we're going to be
eating. They shouldn't disappear.
No, yeah. Absolutely not.
Yeah, and fair enough. I'm of the same opinion. I know there's a lot of people out there who think that the DM should tailor to that specific party. And to a degree, maybe you do. I mean, if they decided to roll up three rogues, and they all wanted to go straight rogue all the way up, with maybe each one dipping a little here or there for something, and they want to play in a Thieves Guild, obviously that's a different adventure than you're running.
Well, I think it's different when the players ask the DM, or if the DM has an idea and says, hey, I'm going to run this monastery intrigue campaign where you guys are all clerics of the same god, but you're going to obviously have different stats, and you're going to have different feats, and or maybe you're not actually all clerics or whatnot, but you're in the monastery for whatever reason. He's building a theme. You can react to the theme. The reverse is also true. If the players came and said, hey, we have this really cool idea. We want to play two gunslingers on the high seas. The DM says, hey, you guys are cool. I'd be happy to run that for you, and hopefully I can keep it interesting.
Sure.
You know, and maybe they can figure it out.
Sure.
Maybe they can just, you know, avoid things that they don't think they can tackle. If it's not an adventure path, that's probably not too hard to do. They can just decide to go the other way.
So as long as you discuss it ahead of time, you're fine.
I think that it's a fun challenge to look at, you know, an adventure path. If, say, you decided to run Carrion Crown,
mm-hmm.
and we only had, you know, two or three players, I don't want you to dumb that down. You know, one could argue maybe we speed up experience a little bit, but probably not. I want to see if my party
is... Well, just based on the system, you don't need to, right?
I mean, well, that's true.
Because if you're splitting it three ways... I would not. I'm a big fan of leveling people up at certain points
mm-hmm.
without just dumping experience completely
sure.
and just leveling up in the story when you want to level them up. However, if you have a three-person party running through something that was designed for four, I actually really like experience points since they're going to kind of outpace and kind of bring them back as a three-person party into power alignment a little bit, you're still never going to overcome that action economy piece of it.
Sure.
Just like if you're running a larger party, they have extra action economy.
You're going to have more gold, too, if you're splitting it by less people.
Absolutely.
So, but getting back to that, I personally think that it'd be a fun challenge to look at that and say, hey, can we build a party together through planning and talking? Can we find a way to tackle this with less people in the party? What comes to mind is, well, the game that we're playing in, that idea originally started out with a friend and I talking about, hey, can we make a three-person party, and instead of doing the standard archetypes, can we, all three of us, as kind of a theme, kind of a fun theme, take one of the new classes out of, say, the APG.
Hybrids, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Absolutely, right. Take a hybrid class, and can three hybrids shore up those deficiencies? Can you have an Inquisitor and an Alchemist and a Summoner? All three of those things are, you know, very versatile. They all have, you know, healing spells on their spell lists. So there's
Does Summoner heal?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes. So
I should read them more.
So, you know, could you make it through? Can the Summoner, you know, act as kind of a tank and have some skills and do some summons controls? Can that Alchemist kind of do some buffs and do some melee damage too? Or do range? They do range pretty well, right? Can that...
Or control, or... Yeah.
Insert whatever. Can the...
Turns out, no. No, the Alchemist player will not take the 1 feat or discovery he needs to buff people. He's only going to do it to himself because he's selfish. He's a selfish little gnome girl. No, I'm just kidding. Oh, I did that right out.
No, it's okay. But I think building for that could be really fun. And, you know, the strongest argument against, you know, that specific party would be, hey, where's your full base attack bonus? But, you know, it may not be necessary. And as we found, it hasn't really been necessary. And there's some great classes in the main book, though, some hybrid classes. Druid Aside, which is kind of just an uber class to begin with.
Bards.
Right, Bard. It's a great class. It's the OG, the OG hybrid.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. So, I guess shifting gears just a little bit, we have harkened back, not only in this episode, but in past ones, to, you know, talk to your players, talk to your GM, plan.
I think we get that tattooed.
Yeah. No, that's our motto. That's actually going to be the new subline on all our things. It'll be in the intro somewhere. But what do you do if someone doesn't want to talk about it? What do you do if they're just like, oh, I don't know, I'm just going to kind of make my character as I go. I have no idea what I'm going to do. I might... You know,
be a barbarian druid rogue.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you have to just
roll with it.
Just roll with it and smile. I mean, ultimately, yeah, we're playing a game together, and we're all going to try to have a good time. And if you don't agree on every choice, something that comes to mind, I can dig back to a personal experience where there's a player that I was playing with had a rogue. As soon as that player had 20,000 gold jingling in his pocket, he was out to buy a ring of invisibility. And I'm thinking to myself, doesn't that player already have, like, maxed out stealth? Do they really need to have a ring of invisibility of all things? I mean, not that it's not great in the hands of a rogue, not that it's not great in the hands of a fighter or anybody else.
Sure.
But are there...
anyone who doesn't need to drop that much money on it, it might be him.
Right, and is there anything better that you could spend 20,000 gold, which is pretty hefty, I think, at the level that the player bought it at? It's got to be like 5 or 6 or 7 or something. The amount of other gear, even if it was a collection of lesser gear, could have made that character so much more effective.
Sure.
But they go for that one thing.
Yeah.
So
sometimes you just have to let them
make those mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, you can give them your reasons, you can give them your thinking, and when they throw it all right out the window, you gotta just walk away and let that go and know that they're having fun the way they want to play and
can't play their characters for them.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean, if it's a con or something, you say, no, get out of my table.
he's pack up your stuff and leave. And you give him the eye. I'm not playing with you, invisible man.
But you know, I don't know. It just depends. It's all situational.
Sure.
I think a lot of us play with you know, a party that we've known for a long time. And if you're playing with friends, oftentimes there's that guy in the party, that guy in the group that, you know, maybe isn't the best role player, or maybe always has to have X, Y, or Z. fancies himself a genius, so can never have a low intelligence, even though, right?
Right.
Insert whatever idiosyncrasy happens. I think a lot of people can identify with that. You've got the guy who, what's another on this vein? What's the other ones you see? Overgeared guy who has to have, you know, every situational piece of gear from the equipment section because you never know.
Yes, I wrote down chalk. It's right here on my character. Let me see your character sheet. Okay, here it is. Yeah, definitely.
Right. And that can be just as annoying as guy who doesn't care.
Right.
Wait, you spent what? How much of your gold did you spend? You had 500 gold and you spent 50 gold of it? Yeah, I bought a sword and some leather armor. But you're a paladin. Yeah, I bought a sword and some leather armor. Yeah. You know,
I wasn't really sure what to buy, so I only spent like 15 of my gold before we went on this adventure, and turns out I could have bought like arrows and stuff, but I didn't bother.
I am guilty of doing that one time.
I think we're all guilty of several things we'll talk about throughout the course of these here. Many of the different things you've just spoken about can apply to me at various times. I just gave it a crap because it was recent.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. It just depends. So getting back to this party dynamic.
So, I guess, and this is a little off topic as well, but just kind of talking about what we were just talking about. What if you have a player who's just not interested in making an effective character, and so he's not contributing to the party?
Wow, that's... you know, I'm going to say...
He wants to run away from combat, so he's not helping you in combat, yet he's there for his share of the treasure.
Okay.
When he is there in combat, he does, you know, average of 4 damage per combat, and, you know, he's just, you know...
You're making this really juicy. Every time I have something else comes out. You know, it really just all boils down to the role-playing aspect of it.
Okay.
At the end of the day, I, as much as I like to be a hard-ass and love to kill players... I will coddle people and say that it's okay to spend the whole session role-playing. I love the details, I love the characterization of it, and if they have a reason, and if they truly enjoy that character, and there are good reasons why that character is a sniveling coward, but greedy,
right,
but is annoying and doesn't want to go away, if it works, I can't imagine how that works, but if it works somehow in the role-playing aspect, I would not veto it, and I wouldn't kick the player out for that.
So, in law, there's things called tests, where they test different situations against certain things to determine how they should adjudicate that. And so one of the tests for this type of thing might be, is this person abusing the PC written on his forehead? If he wasn't here, if he never showed up to the table and he, you know, that chair was empty and you didn't have the skill set you're expecting him to be there, say he's your only trap finder, would you hire an NPC who did the same stuff he does and give him a full share of the treasure?
Well, what I just said applies both ways. I expect that player who makes that cowardly, greedy character to play his character to the utmost, and I'm going to hold him to it. I also expect the other players in character to also play their characters to the utmost. And I think it's more important for those players to not see that floating PC sign above his head. And if he does really piss them off in character, if those characters don't want his character there, then they have that responsibility to play their characters to the utmost and kick him out of the party in character, not necessarily the player at the table.
Joe, we love you playing with us.
Right, and you can take him to the side. Hey, can you make something else? We thought
Sir
that was
Gilligan
really fun.
Sucks. He needs to go.
Absolutely. Yeah. If it fits. But if he does his job well, he may really endear himself.
Sure.
To the party. I mean, you could have...
he's Nodwick or something. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, he was pretty... Nodwick was pretty smart. I think that for me, the answer is always going to be, as a default answer, is that role-playing trumps insert anything else.
Agreed.
With the caveat that this is a group game and everyone needs to have fun.
Yep.
So, you know, so role-playing would trump everything, except in that if you make some super melodramatic drama queen, and now every session is all about you and your emotions and how you're feeling.
Everyone having fun, in my mind, trumps everything.
Well, yes.
Role-playing comes next.
Okay, right.
Mechanics come last.
Sure.
Of those.
Right.
Or wargaming, I should say. But all of them are fun. I don't want to diss wargaming.
I love me some wargaming.
Absolutely. But it doesn't mean those other things aren't important. And we're going to talk a lot about stuff in these podcasts where we're geeking on the rules. And yeah, we're both optimizers and min-maxers, but that doesn't mean we don't think role-playing is the number one thing, you know, and having fun is what the game's about.
Well, one of the funnest things for me, and I'm sure you share this too, is when optimizing a character is defining those rules.
Yes.
You know, it's not just sitting down, hey, I want to, you know, and for me, at least, from my role-playing career, if you will, I've played enough and done enough and designed enough characters that I'm not just going to sit down and say, hey, I'm going to design a really good tank, or hey, I'm going to design a really cool fighter or guy. I'm going to define it much, much more closely. Hey, I'm going to make a guy who uses a whip, or uses a whip to do this.
Right.
And when you have that idea that starts as a role-playing idea, as a fun idea, and then you find a way to make it work, I mean, those types of optimizations become a challenge for you.
Yeah, and then you can build the character around those.
And they can bring out the roleplay.
They interplay between each other. As, you know, you're coming up with character ideas, as you're building the character and his personality and everything else, then maybe you're like, well, maybe a whip wasn't my thing. Maybe it's going to work best with the goosey arm.
Sure.
Does that ruin the character I'm already building? Yes. So I'm going to stick with the whip. Even though it's not the optimal thing, because it's more fun in a role-playing, maybe that did trump that decision, but I made it as a conscious decision.
I think the most boring thing, or the worst thing that someone can do, is to always default to the same old tried-and-true things. Well, I'm always going to play the spike chain fighter, because I know that's effective. I mean, obviously not so much in Pathfinder, but in 3.5.
Right, right.
Or, you know, well, I'm playing a wizard again. Here's the default loadout for spells again. And I think those are the things
exact
that,
same wizard back to back to back.
Right.
Yeah.
And while effective in 95% of the combats, it's going to just be boring. And I don't think that the role playing is going to be there. It's going to be very hard to justify it. You know, I'm a regurgitated mage. I mean, I think it should be an archetype, regurgitated
mage. What's interesting
mage.
Is there are players who want to do that. That's all they want to do, and that's what they're going to have fun doing. I guess,
a way to roleplay it really well. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, I mean,
you
I guess
came
I don't
from
want
the
to
academy
throw
and
too much.
You didn't get to write your own spell book. This is what you found, and it had all of these regurgitated spells.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and it would be funny if you, like, damn it, I hate this reverse gravity.
Yes, that actually would be very funny.
Dominate, what a crappy spell. And you were just totally mad they didn't have the really cool spells.
I really
like,
wanted Fireball. Why doesn't this guy have Fireball?
Where's my magic missile? You know, I mean, I think that, you know, you could take it and you could roleplay it well. Like, if you went to a con and somebody gave you a sheet and handed you this wizard and you just drop your head and you're just like, oh,
the
not
same
again.
Thing. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But, you know, then the role-playing has to shore that up.
Sure, sure. All right, I guess going back to our discussion then about rules, and I kind of want to flip this for a second. So we've talked about rules this whole time. Are there any classes that don't fit any rules?
That's a really good question.
You know, if I said a monk.
Monk.
That's
the first thing that came to my mind,
right?
Yeah.
Does the monk not do any of these well, or do them so poorly that it's not worth playing?
The monk's pretty horrible. He got better in Pathfinder.
Sure.
The rogue has better skills, can have better damage output. Pretty much everything has better damage output. Small healing. You know, the thing is, I'm a real big fan of the new archetypes, and there's
if you
some...
even without archetypes, if you make a grappling rogue, and your whole thing is you just fly past all the opposition, tumbling where you need to tumble, you run to the back, you grab their wizard, and you get him in a headlock... you suddenly are a controller.
Sure.
Yeah, you're like one spell, but you did just take out the main threat, and you just identified the linchpin of that fight.
Right.
You took it out so the rest of your people can mop up what else is going on. Yeah, you could argue that the wizard could have done that with one spell and then, you know, wandered over to do other things at the same time, but I still think they can be effective in things.
So the complete antithesis of the monk being the wizard, he has too many niches.
Right.
He can just do too many things.
Right.
Or even
the fighter can be that way. I mean, if you look at the fighter as a class without archetypes, you see a bunch of okay, I'm good with armor. I'm apparently good with weapons, but I don't know which weapons. And I get a bunch of feats. There's so many choices they could fill. That if you don't think about it and build an actual build, there's
it's
too
easy
many
to be
niches.
Ambiguous, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard.
And then you're not good at anything. Yeah.
Right. It does take some focus and a strong design from the beginning to take that basic fighter, and he's great because you can make him into anything you want to, but you have to clearly define that from the get go. I think that's one of the great things about those archetypes is they help to guide a player who has an idea. He says, well, you know, I really want to play this kind of mounted Lancey type of character, but I want to be a fighter. You know, you sure you can just build that, or you can take that Dragoon. And yeah, it's a fantastic archetype. It's really fun and flavorful.
And he's and reading through that might inspire you to make more characters than just reading fighter would have.
Absolutely.
Which is also great.
So, but as far as fitting in or not fitting in, Monk's probably about the worst, I'd say.
So does that mean you shouldn't play Monk? Or does it mean it's a challenge to play a monk? Then you should roll one up in the next game you play.
Real men play monks. I will take up that gauntlet,
Challenge accepted.
My next character will be a monk, and I will report how it goes.
I kind of agree, too. I think there's any class you can find, there's something it can do well. You could play a commoner and just, based on feats, make them do something well. Yeah, it's going to be the most challenging of anything to do, but yeah, you could find something. You could make them play. I can think of, I bet Barry could sit down, make a monk, or I'm sorry, a commoner, who by fifth level is more effective than some other people's characters who are...
Well, I'm blushing. I'm not going to agree with that necessarily. Commoners are pretty suck class, but thank you, Ed. That the vote of confidence. Vote of confidence.
Well, it's basically saying with the worst BAB, worst saves, worst weapons, and only feats to choose from.
It's possible to do one thing fairly okay.
Yeah.
But you know, yeah, sure. It just depends what you want to get into.
All right. So what about changing them? Does the monk need to be changed? Should it be house ruled in every game to have something different than it has right now?
Nope, that's why we have archetypes.
All right, fair enough.
Yep,
fair enough.
I think that the Zen Archer Monk is actually a strong contender for one of the better archer builds out there.
Sure, and that grappling monk whose name I can't think of.
Tatori.
Yes,
he's pretty cool too.
I still can't pronounce it, even though you just did.
Sure.
Yeah, he can be extremely interesting and extremely flavorful and fun to play.
The drunken monk is fun.
It's a beautiful dip, just because it's not a wonderful class in and of itself. It still can be a really strong dip in some cases, although you can make the argument just taking a level 1 fighter can give you most of the same stuff, especially with archetypes.
I think that the monk is a really great role-playing class. If you have an idea for why he's a monk, what he wants to do, but going back to non-effective characters, I think the monk, more than anybody, can really take that and run with it. There's an archetype that makes a monk even less effective. I forget the name of it, but they basically...
Is it called Rogue? No, I'm just kidding.
No, it changes. Okay, so like Monk of the Healing Hand, he's not even close to a cleric. He sucks. He's like the worst healer in the game, and you're sacrificing your...
So he's the worst at a role that isn't really necessary.
Yes.
It's a trap.
Monk of the Lotus is pretty horrible, too. I mean, it's kind of some role-playing stuff, like Touch of Serenity. You can, like, calm people down. But it's just, why? Yeah. Why would you take that? Like, so on the subject of the monk, just right there, I remember something that I was looking at the other day that makes the monk not quite so horrible. So the one that I was talking about that's probably the worst monk archetype you can get is the monk of the... Monk of the Healing Hand, and the Monk of the Lotus kind of sucks too, but basically the Monk of the Healing Hand is, hi, I'm a healer, but I'm not nearly as good as any of the other healers, and I'm not as good of a monk either. Great way to fail. But I'd like to touch real quick, since I was slamming Monk, there's something in the APG, they brought in Monk Vows, and these things are crazy powerful. You just get a ton of extra ki. They also follow that with the Qui-Gon Monk archetype that uses ki powers to do things, but monks are... There's a lot of different things that the monks can do with ki anyway. One of the things that you can do with this is you can take all of the vows, and as you go up in levels, you get extra ki to your ki pool. If you ever end up breaking your vows, then that vow is broken. You can't gain any more ki as you get up in levels from that vow, but you keep all the ki that you got on the way. So you just take all the vows and you break the ones that don't really work.
Whenever
for you.
It comes up in game, you just break it.
Well, I mean, no, if you can't get by,
you collect ki until it comes up.
Well, like for instance, no, I mean you do it as well as you can, as well as you can stand.
It's inconvenient.
Right, exactly. Say like the vow of chains, or so you're walking around. You know, you have a penalty to your AC. You're walking around with these chains heavily on you to show, you know, your empathy for the suffering people, but then you get knocked off a ship.
suddenly you want to swim.
Suddenly you don't want those chains anymore. Well, I think dying is a good incentive to, you know, take off those chains and break that vow.
I don't think being an anchor really represents well.
But that's pretty good. So side note, not sure when or if that's going to end up anywhere, but I'd like to make the Qui-Gon Monk work. That'd be kind of cool. They have a lot of options.
So in closing, just taking us right back to where we started, are there roles in the game?
Yes and no. There's definitely things that need to be done, but whether you as your party sit down and clearly define the roles is up to you. And the roles in the game, well, okay, so I guess the answer is yes, there are roles, but they're not the final four. Yeah. Depending on the game, you could need, you know, anything from massive undead mitigation, you could need a lot of diplomacy, you could need lots of friends or summons or what have you. So,
and I'm going to completely agree. The roles are there. They are in the game. They're not explicit. They're implicit. But they're guidelines, not restrictions. You shouldn't say, I'm in this role, therefore I can't do anything else. You should say, I'm in this role. I want to make sure I do that awesome. What else can I do?
Right. Don't think that your party's going to fail because you don't have a cleric to heal you.
Yes.
And I'd like to say that as much as we did talk about not needing the controller as much, I think that the dedicated healer is a good one to take out as well. I think that, you know, for instance, in the three-player party that I illustrated, if everyone has some heals or has at least access to the healing tree or path to get the wands, why do you need a dedicated healer? If everyone can kind of take care of themselves and you're healing out of combat anyway.
Likewise, if everyone can take a hit, why do you need a tank?
Absolutely.
You know, maybe it's just, okay, the plan is that we're going to all need some healing, and the amount of healing we'll need at the end is spread out among us instead of on one person.
Sure, that's absolutely fine. I think that with proper planning and kind of knowing what you want to be as a party, but that has to be also tempered with knowing what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah.
So the DM is just chuckling maniacally
if
in the corner.
You know, I mean, sometimes you're making decisions based on nothing because your DM doesn't want to talk to you about it or whatever. You know, he hasn't come up with a plan yet.
Well, ultimately, he's got to remember it. He has to remember then caveat number one: everybody, including him, needs to have fun at the table.
Absolutely.
As much as I love
and
killing
you
players,
you need to trust your DM to do that.
Right.
If you don't, find a new game. Don't stay in that game. It's not, oh, he didn't tell me this time. If you don't trust him to have fun, he shouldn't be your DM.
If they see it coming, it's not as fun to wipe everybody.
Right.
So you need to let them have a good time.
You need to talk about how easy the AP is and how the first adventures really are just a warm-up session. And then you give them a 37-point buy, and then you kill them all.
Right. So if you manipulate the party, say, yeah, sure, go ahead and roll up a cavalier and heavily armored tanks, and then you put them on a ship.
Yep. Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, no, that's no problem at all. Yeah, you guys should totally do that. Oh, you should play an alchemist, too. Oh, yeah, you can have an alchemist lab. Oh, by the way, we're all in a shipwreck. That's the very first encounter. All that glass? Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't make it. Yeah. It sucks.
No, you're
sucks.
Naked.
Yeah. Sorry, all your class skills don't work. So I think that's about it, though. I think we agree on a lot of stuff here.
We'll need to argue much more in the next session.
We will. I think there's a lot of stuff that's sort of common knowledge, common thought, common wisdom, I don't know, common sense. Maybe common is a bad way to put it, but there's a lot of stuff out there that's, people think we have to fill these roles, people think we have to play this way, people think the cleric has to be a healer. Don't limit yourself. Class is not a restriction. You can do lots of things with a single class. Two different clerics could be completely different. Two different monks could be completely different. Two different tanks could be completely different. Two different strikers. I mean, I could go on forever here.
Sure.
Don't let any of it be a restriction in what you play. Let it be a guide. Let it be something that helps you understand what you're doing with that character, but don't let it restrict what you're doing with that character.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have to admit, I'm guilty of one thing. I think that we talked a lot about clerics and how people don't want to be pigeonholed into being the healer. I'm guilty. If I love me some rogue, and I refuse to be a trap finder. For me, in the game, it's boring. You know, as a veteran player, if it's one thing that incites a snooze session, it's going through the doors, going through the motions. I don't want to mess with it. I don't even really want that on my character, I'll be honest. If I was making a rogue for a game, probably make a ninja and remove, or if I just, you know,
I love that almost every archetype this is trap finder. I love it.
I think I they do. Know. If I make the knife master, you know, I'm glad to get rid of trap finding and have an excuse not to do it, and redefine what the rogue is.
Yeah.
Find a way to get around that trap, or just have the fighter take the hit.
Yeah.
Right?
Summon a monster, whatever.
Right. I think that...
you know why the summoner has all those summoning spells, even though the Eidolon is so awesome? He's also the rogue.
That's what I'm saying. You
Not
know?
Only is his Eidolon a better tank than anyone else than the fighter is in the group, he's also the rogue with his, you know, summon monkeys or whatever.
Hey, you know what I say? There are absolutely perks to being the sidekick.
Yeah.
If you know you're not the powerhouse, look to your cleric and your wizard. What are you guys doing? Yeah. Why are you looking at me?
You're supposed to do everything.
You disarm the trap.
God.
Right.
Or, where's your god now, cleric?
Exactly. Take that, tier ones.
That's right. Godzilla your ass on over there.
Defy what you want to do and have fun with it. And, you know, make the character you want to play. I think that's the most important thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Unless you're in a discussion and you said, yes, I will be a trap finder, then not having... you know, perception and disable device would be a bastardly thing to do. But if you're upfront about that, though, and you're like, hey, we want you to be the trap finder, and you say, hose off.
Sure.
That's fine.
Don't say you're going to be a tracker and forget survival.
Is assuming you understand the rules and know that survival is necessary to track. Yes, I agree. Agreed. So I think that's about it. Thanks for tuning in.
Yep.
And we will see you guys next time.
Okay.
The Gamer's Guide to Pathfinder. Dun dun dun!